Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Tuesday actually, and we have a spring break in college. I was going to do, I have to do something for the bio or the history or something. I was going to do something on Italy for Rumi Sager, but I think I'll put that off for next week. Instead, we'll do one for my good friends Ari Elbaum, Ari and Heather Elbaum, and Fred Hoffman for his recent birthday. And it has to do with old Baltimore. So that's what I intend to speak about. I noticed in the paper, everybody's talking about this lady who gave a billion, I say, to Einstein. You know what I'm talking about, right? Mrs. Gottesman. I don't know her. And I saw an article, and a bunch of things clicked in my head. And it's an interesting story as far as I'm concerned. I want to share it with you. That this old lady, again, who I don't know, unfortunately, you know, she's not a sponsor of podcasts, $1 billion, woo. But I went to a Jewish thing. Einstein is sort of a Jewish thing. She's from Baltimore. But an old family with a very interesting history and at different times. I don't think most of the people listening to these podcasts are in Baltimore, know Baltimore very well. But Baltimore's always had a very unique kind of history. It's the most important town you never heard of, certainly Jewish. And it's very remarkable in a number of respects. And I'll tell you what I mean. If you go back 150 years ago, so the first Jews in Baltimore, about 10, 20,000, were German Jews almost always. Almost totally. That's what it was in America altogether. You know, there have been waves, correct? So, you know, the beginning was the Portuguese Jews, but very early on, even at the time of George Washington, most of the people coming were German Jews, even if they joined Portuguese synagogues and did the Minhag Sfarad and all that business. But they weren't really, you know, by background Portuguese Jews. They weren't Sfaradim by background. That's why if you look at the 17, 1800s, you see a lot of names associated with historic synagogues in America, like the Sheretz Israel in New York, and you know the what do you call it, the Newport, and the one in Charleston, Beis Elohim, and all the others. A lot of names are actually not Sephardic at all. So that's what it was. But the big wave of immigration came starting around 1830. Up to then, there were probably 6,000 or 7,000 Jews, or 8,000 in the whole U.S. It's garnished. In the time of George Washington, it was 2,500. The numbers were very small. Now, between 1830 and 1870, 1880, came 250,000 German Jews. 250,000, that's a lot. So, we're talking about, we say Germany, I mean, Central Germany, Central Europe, they identified as Germans. Let's say, for example, you came from Bohemia or somewhere, you know, it's Czech, but they talked German at that time, Bohemia, Moravia. Certainly, we came from Germany, Gufa. A lot of them came here to Baltimore from Bavaria, southern Germany. That's what it was. Now, you know and I know that these Jews came over here to make a buck, which is nothing wrong, and they did. And by and large, remember, that was the old America. There was no social welfare programs, no unemployment insurance, nothing like that. You either sink or swim. So it's pure capitalism, or as close as you can get to it. And a lot of these, the German Jews, did well. I mean, you know, they worked hard and built up businesses and so forth and so on. Fine. Now, that means if you're in Baltimore, you came here, let's say, 1860, 1870, 1880, it's primarily German Jews. And I think we also know that they all want reform. The reform movement triumphed in America in a way that it did not do elsewhere. It triumphed in America in the second half of the 1800s, specifically among the German Jews. So it must have had some kind of particular appeal to that element. German Jews are businessmen, didn't have much of an education. They were, you know, pretty well integrated into society in terms of business, whatever the shot you want to give it. And so all across the United States, over and over again, you had a situation where congregations started Orthodox and switched to be Reformed. 1860s, 70s, 80s, 90s. You know, you can go across the United States. Very rarely did you have a German Jewish group that started and kept an Orthodox congregation, particularly Shomer Shabbos. It was very hard in America at that time. I mean, it could be done. You know, don't get me wrong. It certainly could be done. But it wasn't done. Now, Baltimore is a little bit of an exception, which is interesting because it's different than most other cities, if not all, in the United States in that tekufa. Because in Baltimore, you had, I'm trying to simplify this for the audience, you had two groups of German Jews who, for one reason or another, made shuls that were specifically anti-Reform and were pro-Orthodox. One's called Chizik Amunah, the other one's called Sheretz Yisrael. Today's Chizik Amunah is a conservative shul. Today's Sheretz Yisrael is still a very firm shul. The Glen Avenue shul, they call it in Baltimore. Now, what's interesting is, there was no chinuch. So in others, there was no day school, certainly no yeshivas, anything like that. And it was simply the orthodoxy of immigrants who came over and never dropped their Shmir Shabbos, as we would say today. He had something like that. He had enough to make a small shul here and a small shul there. They weren't large shuls. And of the two, the Sheretz Yisrael was more to the right. The Chizik Amunah is more to the left. But they all were Shomer Shabbos more one degree or another. Now, the German Jews, including the Frum, eventually made money, most of them, in businesses. You know, nothing illegal about it. In businesses. Baltimore was a very important city in the United States at that time because of the clothing industry. You know, especially, you're going to laugh at this, especially hats, straw hats, things like this. Mostly usually made in Baltimore, sold all over the country. But other things as well. Now, if you were growing up in the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, things start to change because a ton of Eastern European Jews come. So whereas Baltimore had been a city, a large community of, I think, between 10 and 20,000, almost all German Jews, now it like tripled with 40 or 45,000 Jews from Eastern Europe. The two didn't get along so well because of the cultural differences between them. Now, I have to modify what I'm saying. The Reform certainly didn't get along with the immigrants coming over because they talk Yiddish. They're Shomer Mitzvahs, many of them. It's just a different worldview. And the Reform was already like super, and I'm talking about the age of classical Reform, where it was like super duper Reform, you know, no yarmulkes, no nothing. Purim and Hanukkah are not celebrated. The davening is really a joke. I mean, you know, it was very different. On the other hand, if you came to Baltimore, there were two Frum shuls, German Jews. They spoke German at Yiddish and all that sort of thing. That's true. And they were fairly Americanized by the time I'm talking about. But nevertheless, they're Frum Jews. And therefore, they have a lot in common with the Eastern European Jews, even though they also have a lot not in common. It's just interesting. Baltimore became a very interesting place. And these two shuls had interesting histories because, especially in the early years, it was all Germans, and then many Eastern European Jews started to join those shuls as well. Okay? Now, question is, how long will the Frumkeit last if there's no yeshivas, no chinuch, no day schools? That is a very valid question. But you know and I know that nothing really happened in terms of chinuch until much later. There was a day school didn't start till 1917, and even then it was only up to 6th grades. Near Israel Yeshiva didn't start till 1933. And again, it was very small in the beginning. It was in the 40s and 50s that, you know, chinuch took off here. And ever since then, Baltimore has been a very different place. So I'm talking about before that. So, if you had this Chizuk HaMunishol, which went through four iterations, it was downtown, it was a little bit more north of that, and then it was a big place, a Utah place, and now it's out in Stevenson, out in the suburbs. I mean, really the suburbs. So, this shul went through various, what's the right word? Mutations. but still was an Orthodox shul. And officially was committed to everything, and they still had many members that were totally Shomer Shabbos. One of the important families was Levi. You know, there was a couple who came from Germany, and they stayed from, they really were, they had 10 children. And they went into the hat business, and they did, straw hats, I think. And they did very well. And so their children went into the business, and their children went into business, you know, like that. That was a classic, a German-Jewish story, even though they're Shomer Shabbos. You understand what I'm saying? These people didn't go to college. They weren't interested in college. Their children and grandchildren would be different, but they didn't go to college. They said, we're going to make money in business, which is where you make serious money. And they became prominent in the Chizuk HaMunishol. Now here come, and their children grew up. Now here's the interesting thing. Growing up at that time, who do you marry? You want to marry somebody Jewish, hopefully. Who do you marry? There aren't that many, right? Aren't that many boys and girls? I mean, there are. So let's say you're Orthodox. There's no Beis Yaakov or anything like that. Everything is public school. There's going to be social activities. You want boy to meet girl, right? Am I right? I mean, you want boy to meet girl. They didn't have such a thing like Shadchanim and all this kind of whole elaborate system they got today. And so how does it work? So the interesting thing I'm bringing out is, in the case of Baltimore, I don't know the other towns, you had a lot of intermarriage between the Reform and the Orthodox. Isn't that interesting? Because they're all German Jews. They're all from the same social and financial class. They're all successful businessmen to one degree or another. And so boy and girl will have a lot in common, even though you'd say, but look how much you have not in common. This one's Shomer Shabbos and all the rest of it, and the Kashrus, and this one is not. I get that. And that makes the story very interesting. But it happened a fair amount, because since they're all from the same economic class, they did a lot of things together. You go to the concert and the country clubs. I'm serious. And the fact that one Shomer Shabbos and one's not didn't interfere with that necessarily. And you go, they both go to Atlantic City, which was a ritzy place once upon a time, and places like that. And so the socializing, the social interaction, be from people from the same class, even though they have differences in religious practice. So it's very interesting. No one's written a book on this. Probably be a very interesting book. How'd it work out? If she's from and he's not, or he's from and she's not, how's it work out? And the answer is, if you look down the cases, at least what I know, I don't know all of it, obviously. I just know more than you. It was 50-50. Sometimes the from guy went along with the non-from and became non-from. And sometimes the other way around. Now, to say that the from one became non-from because they married a spouse that wasn't from, that's push-up shot. That's easy to understand. Because after all, to keep Shabbos, to keep everything, I mean, you need a tag team working with it, a husband and wife. Even now, with all the day schools and shibas, all the rest of it, if I was married to somebody who wasn't from or something like that, it'd be hard to raise children from. We all know that. So kal vachomer then. So it's not hard to understand that the from one would fall away. What's fascinating to me, to us, listening to this podcast, is the cases where it went the other way around. Where somebody was born not from a reform, stark reform, and when they got married, they flipped and became Shomer Shabbos and Shomer Mitzvahs. And there was a fair amount of that also. That's just interesting, right? Me, myself, and I think I told you once, I did a podcast on Henry Picone here in Baltimore. Was a very good friend of mine. He and his wife passed away. He got married, I think, in 1930. And he was from a very firm family. And his wife, Charlotte, she's from super reform family. She told me she was eating trade flakes till just before they got married. And then she flipped and became super firm. Because she was. You had that. Okay? But again, they're both from the same social background. German Jews, Americanized by 1920s. You know, with this profile, you know, that's how it worked out. Okay? So just imagine a world, which is not so hard for people listening to just imagine, because I don't believe anybody listening to this podcast, or hardly, doesn't have non-firm relatives. And so, do you ever get together with them, this and the other? The answer is yes and no. When I was young, it happened more often. But, you know, weddings, bar mitzvahs, this, that, and the other, funerals. Even the ones from not, people get along. It's harder now because the frum become more frum and all the rest of it. But you hear what I'm saying? This kind of interaction and social basis based around life cycle events and things like that was not uncommon. And so, make a long story short, this Levy family, who were big machers in the Chizuk Emuna, and they were the presidents for many years and all that sort of thing, William Levy. And they, how should I put it? They interacted with people from their own social class. And so the children, the son of this very firm couple who moved to Germany, from Germany to Baltimore and came here, their son married a reform girl from Philadelphia, Beatrice. And she flipped. In other words, she went along with the husband. And so the family, now they weren't as firm with their parents because they're born here, you know, they went to public school, but they were observant. They were Shomer Shabbos. And I don't know the business was, but they were Shomer Shabbos and Kashrus and all the rest of it. This is living a different existence. This is the well-to-do from, maybe from's not the right word, the well-to-do observant from 100 years ago. These are people, now they didn't have chinuch as we would understand today. Torah chinuch. And so these are people who got involved early on in the conservative movement because there was a lot of hope, expectation that the conservative movement would move in a religious direction and would be what we would call today modern Orthodox. It'd be Goldilocks. It'd be exactly the right. Not too much this, not too much that. It'd be just right for America. And so the synagogue, Chizuk Emuna, has the weird distinction of being one of the first shuls that started the Jewish Theological Seminary, and also one of the founding shuls of the OU. Because it wasn't a targeted sasri at that time. And again, he married somebody who was very reform from Philadelphia. Stern was the name of the family. And they lived in Baltimore. And they're very prominent in Baltimore affairs. I think they founded the Associated. In Baltimore, you have the federations called the Associated Jewish Charities, because there used to be two federations, the German Jews and the Eastern European Jews, uptown and downtown, as they call it. In the early decade of the 20th century, this guy Levy and others said it's more efficient to create one organization, but neither one wanted to lose its identity, so therefore, instead of saying you have one federation, you have the Associated. Get it? Notice you're here and I'm there, but we're joined together. We don't lose our identity. Today, it's all one thing, but I'm talking about that time, 100, 120 years ago. So this is the history of American Judy once upon a time. So now, this couple was very active in this Chizuk Emuna congregation, which moved slowly, slowly to the left, but was still Orthodox. So in other words, they were affiliated with the conservative movement, but they had a fully kosher mechitza and, you know, davening and siddur and all that sort of thing. The original 30 members, I mean, they were all pretty firm. But after that, a lot of people joined, hundreds joined, when they moved to a better neighborhood, and they weren't also firm at all, not at all. So it became one of the shuls that was very common in my youth, which is an Orthodox shul, but most people not Shomer Shabbos. Some are. This family I'm talking about was interesting because they're rich and they're Shomer Shabbos. And with President Shul, and they made good money. Once upon a time, hats were big in this country. Kennedy killed that. But hats was a big thing. Not only from Jews wear hats. And straw hats especially. And there was a halacha of Moshe Mitzrayim. You don't wear a straw hat until Memorial Day, I think. And you have to take it off after Labor Day. You know, it was a whole culture. So anyhow, whatever it is, this is how things rolled over here. And then the guy, and they were very philanthropic. I remember they gave $20,000 or something like that, $25,000 to this Jewish or that Jewish cause. I mean, that was a fortune in money once upon a time in the 20s. You understand? So they were fine. The guy died, the husband. The wife lived on. Now, here's the thing. He died in the 30s. By the 40s, in America in general, and in Baltimore in particular, that was the big decade of switch to conservative. You know what I'm saying? The conservative movement made a lot of conquests in the 40s and early 50s. That was like their golden years. I mean, one Orthodox shul after another across the country switched to conservative. Now most of them are out of business, but I'm talking about at that time. And Baltimore was no exception, but in an unusual way. Until the Second World War, there was no conservative shul in Baltimore. By that, I mean conservative. The Chizuk Emunah that I spoke about before did regard itself as part of the conservative movement, and they raised money for the Jewish Theological Seminary. They also gave money for YU, by the way. You understand? And they had this mixed kind of identity. And this is the shul where the late, great Rabbi Forschlager gave a daf yomi every day. So, I mean, that's not a typical conservative shul. I mean, he had people there who went to his gemara class, his daf yomi class, from the shul. And the people there were very nice to him and respect him and all the rest of it, even though he was a million times more from than they were. But he felt comfortable doing that, right? Now, you understand, it's interesting. I tell you, Baltimore has its own waves, shall we say. Anyhow, this is how the situation went. But in the 40s, there started to be a big push by certain members in different shuls to have a thing conservative. Why? Did they discover the philosophy of Salman Shechter? No, they wanted mixed seating. That's what it boiled down to. That was the Mishigas. Mixed seating shows were modern. Mixed seating shows were progressive. Mixed seating will retain the younger generation, they said. Et cetera, et cetera. Now, it didn't hit Baltimore until the 40s. Until then, every shul, other than the three Reformed temples, was Orthodox, and they had one degree or another. You had Orthodox service. But in the 40s, there were two big shuls that were like left-wing Orthodox, let's put it that way, which most of the people at that time were not Shomer Shabbos, but the shuls were still, Kedin. One was a Beth Tefillah and one was a Chizuk Emunah. There was a group in the Beth Tefillah of well-to-do guys. They wanted to throw their weight around. And they said, let's make mixed seating and all that here in Beth Tefillah and turn it into a conservative shul. Because the rabbi there also went to the Jewish Theological Seminary, although he really was a from guy. The son of the famous Yossel Rosenblatt. And he fought it, and he won. It was a bloody fight. I'm not going into that story right now. It's a bloody fight. And the losers seceded like the Confederacy in the Civil War, and they started their own shul called Bethel. So, and it's still there today. That's the first shul that was conservative in Baltimore, conservative, with separate seating, with mixed seating, and with a different sitter, the whole nine yards, okay? Now, none of those people knew much, but that's what they wanted to do. When that happened, it also spilled over into the Chizuk Emunah. Once they started to make a conservative shul, so a movement started to do that Chizuk Emunah, which was bitterly fought. Guess who the leader was? This lady who had married Levy,
to want this lady, Beatrice, who had been born Reform, and as long as her husband was alive, she was a Shomer Mitzvah. But now that he was dead for about 10 years, something like that, Chayzer Venir, all of her native instincts from being Reform in the first place, grew up, and she led the fight in the shul because she was influential, because she had money. And they switched it to conservative, right? They switched to conservative. When that happened, that's when Rabbi Forshager left. You understand? But I want to tell you something. There were nice people, because I knew the person who took his place, who gave the Daf Yomi. I don't think I'll say the name. It's nothing wrong. I won't say the name now. And I remember my father told me that this rabbi was a very good friend of his, got sick in the 50s, and that's before he had, you know, Medicare, and he had to have operations that cost a fortune, and the shul paid for it. So notice, there were decent people. But anyway, that's how the shul went off the derech, so to speak, because it's Beatrice. Now, which goes to show you, you can take, how's it go? You can take Santa Claus out of Virginia. You can't take Virginia out of Santa Claus. Now, this lady, she and her husband, they had a number of children, including her son Lester, right? And Lester was also the same way. Here's the interesting part. They were big machers in the Chizuk Emunah. On the other hand, they ended up moving to a ritzy place out, on the outskirts of town, Mount Washington. Now it's not. Was it that time? And so they dove into the Glen Avenue Shul to share Sitzra. In other words, he felt comfortable in the former shul. That's where he went Lamais, even though he was a big macher in the Chizuk Emunah as well. And he married also somebody from a reform background, right? Eleanor Cohn. It's all mixed up here in Baltimore. That's why I have to keep it mixed up. They used to have three big department stores, all Jewish. One was Hustler's, one was Heck Company, and one was Hochschild Cohn. Hochschild Cohn was Hochschild and Cohn. And this, I'm taking you back a long time. All the department stores are gone today, you know. But they had their day. When I was a little kid, they were big deals, very big deals. And Cohn is a funny thing because, how's it work now? They were Reform, but one of them, Benno Cohn, I think, married a Strauss, married a Frum girl from the Sheretz Israel. And he followed her. He became a Shomer Shabbos, you know? And he davened the Glen Avenue Shul at the Sheretz Israel. See how it's all tamished? You know, when you have family seders, when you have weddings, when you have funerals, when you have all these people mix of different levels of religiosity. That's how it was. And see, this Lester was the son of Beatrice. He married Eleanor Cohn. And all these people, by the way, were very philanthropic. You know, tzedakah they gave. Anyhow, and they had to work again. So he davened the Glen Avenue Shul, the Sheretz Israel. But listen to this. He was Shomer Shabbos, but his business was working on Saturday. So he couldn't be a member of the Sheretz Israel. He could only be a seat holder. You understand? He could only, you get what I'm saying? You couldn't be a voting member. To be in the Sheretz Israel, Ad Hayom Hazeh, you have to be a Shomer Shabbos. It's always been that way. Used to be an unwritten rule, I think now it's a written rule, whatever. How do you define Shomer Shabbos? This is interesting to me, looking back. I'm going back close to 100 years, 70, 80 years, more than that, 80, 90 years. It's funny because personally they were observant, but the business was open. So the shul wouldn't accept him as members, but that's where he davened all the time. And that means they walked, by the way, a couple miles. I don't know how many miles, but maybe a mile and a half, 2 miles. Not so bad. Still, they walked, you know, from Mount Washington to Davin the Sheretz Israel. It always struck me as funny because I don't know why it never occurred to anybody at that time. You can run a business on Shabbos, I'll be din, if you know the rules. If you do the right kind of shtar mechira and all the rest of it. In other words, if you have an Orthodox rabbi who knows what he's doing, You follow the Shulchan Aruch. There's ways, several ways actually, to have the business running on Shabbos. In which case, he should have been able to do that and been a member of the Shul. I mean, I'm talking about the era of Uri Rabbi Schwab, for example. Shem Schwab, he certainly knew how to write a shtar, the right kind of contractual situations. I myself know a couple of families. I'm not saying any names. The business run on Shabbos, did run on Shabbos, according to the din. You know, I'm not saying it's a great thing, but it's certainly halachically proper and very common in Europe. There's a whole history to that. You can look up in Shulchan Aruch. You see, what's his name wrote a book on this? Jacob Katz, I think it's called The Shabbos Guy, where he discusses the history of this particular issue. But for whatever reason, that's not what the guy did. He wasn't a member of the shul, and so on and so forth. So here you have a very classic Baltimore type situation where, you know, the parents are observant because of their family background. Neither of them went to, schools. Obviously, there's no Beis Yaakov or anything like that. The mother, I think, came from Reform, but they're observant. Wait a second. No, I take it back. The mother was the daughter of that couple I told you, where he was Reformed and she was Orthodox, and they became Orthodox. So the mother also grew up in an Orthodox family. You know what I'm saying? Her father was one of the owners of the big department store who converted to Frumkeit to marry the wife. Okay? It's strange. So both parents came from observant background. But it's hard to explain. Very Americanized. You know, you are observant. You do keep kosher. But you go to the best, public schools or private schools, I would say. And, the old Park School, which was the old German Jewish equivalent of a fancy private school. I went to Goucher College, which was like Barnard or something like that. You know, one of these places. I shouldn't say Barnard. Barnard was actually started by a Jewish woman. But, you know, those kind of, waspy type of situations. Anyway, let that be. Now, so now you have this couple. So his mother was the lady who started the change in the shul to go conservative. But he himself was like the father. And, you know, he was observant. Very American. He's very much into the Peabody Conservatory and Johns Hopkins University, all that kind of stuff. But also, to be fair about, also for, you know, Zionism and for Eretz Yisrael, any support. He gave money, you know, to YU, that sort of thing. They you can't say that they didn't have a very strong background in tzedakah. It's just interesting. It's a different time and place. And so they got married in 1922. And that means you grow up in Baltimore in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, rich. So that's like a gilded lifestyle, shall we say. Like I say, you go to Hopkins or to Goucher, and you go to this school, you meet the right people, and you're very in the arts and sciences, very American, go to the opera, all the rest of it. At the same time, you don't work on Shabbos. Yeah? You do keep kosher. It's interesting. So this family, as I say, grew up, and as the shul went conservative, so did they. And I don't know details of the family. I only know the outside of what I'm telling you. Their daughter is the lady that gave the billion. Isn't that something? Their daughter is the lady that gave the billion. So notice she's from old Baltimore. I saw somewhere she's in her 90s. So it means that she was born around 19, now it's not 2024, so she was born around 1930, Baruch, something like that. So she's growing up like the way I just told you. She married a Jewish guy, and I don't know if they were religious. I don't think they're religious. I mean, I don't think they're Orthodox. I could be wrong. Her parents were involved in Jewish affairs in that kind of way, like forever, in Baltimore. And by that, I mean, they're involved in the conservative movement, in the Shul, and also in the Federation, also in the NAACP, and, you know, all the good liberal causes. I mean, you know, for child education and, you know, sanitation, all kind of good things for all people. Very American. I'm talking about America doesn't exist anymore. I'm afraid to say now with all this Arab stuff and the war going on in Gaza. So she married, obviously, this guy Gottesman, and, you know, he became a billionaire on through business. I heard he was connected with Warren Buffett. I don't know. And she's the one who gave $1 billion. But she gave it to Albert Einstein. So nobody should have to have to pay tuition. Isn't that interesting? So notice she had enough. I don't know her. I wish I knew her. you know, that's the famous story. How's it go? The Rothschild's funeral in Vienna. There's a big, people are walking, and behind is an old lady from Eastern Europe crying. And he said, why are you, it sounds better in Yiddish. He said, why are you crying? You weren't related to Rothschild. I said, that's why I'm crying. You know? But she obviously, therefore, is carrying on a very interesting, intertwined, longstanding Baltimore tradition, even though she doesn't live here. And she certainly has made a mark by giving $1 billion. Now, I'm sure we all say like this, why couldn't you give $1 billion for chinuch? I get that. You know, that's a fair question. But to be perfectly honest, that's not what catches people's imagination, unless you're from. And the family I'm talking about was observant, but not from. And therein lies the tale. But anyway, I don't want to take anything away. It's a big, donation. And frankly, right now, the state of Israel could use $1 billion with this war going on. But, you know, you can't tell someone else how to spend their money. Let's put it that way. Maybe we'll all get lucky, and some other person will come along with a stranger background than I just described, and we'll give $1 billion to a Tiramisura or something like that. No, don't give it to them, but give it to the schools. Who knows? But anyway, I thought that was just an interesting angle. And like I said before, it's very interesting, these intermarriages. By intermarriage, I mean, one is reform and one's conservative. One's not from where it's from. You have this nowadays. You can have parents of different backgrounds. It's never easy. But we do see that sometimes when we have this quote-unquote intermarriage, one accommodates to the other. And each variety is just different and interesting. And that's what makes life interesting. Anyway, I thought I'd share that. Again, I want to thank Irene Heather and happy birthday to Ed Hoffman. With that, I wish you all a good week and an upcoming Purim.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.